Hello and welcome to Murph's Tavern. I am massive Simpsons dork Murphy McLaughlin. Usually on this podcast, we talk about a different episode of The Simpsons. However, we're mixing things up today. We're going to be talking about Simpsons comics, books, merch, and more with a special guest. It's his second time on the podcast. He was not only the creative director at Bongo Comics and the editor of a bunch of Simpsons books, including the complete guides, but he's illustrated and designed countless items of official Simpsons products. Basically, listeners, if you own any Simpsons merch, which I'm sure you do, there's a very good chance this guest had something to do with it. It's an honor to have him here again, the man behind the merch, Bill Morrison. Welcome back.
Thanks, Merv. How you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. You like that spiel? You're happy with that?
Yeah, that was great. The man behind the merch. I love it.
That can be on your business cards, right?
Or my tombstone.
Yeah. Either works. How you been? It's March 2024. You've been hitting up the comic cons lately?
Yeah, I think this year I've already been to, four.
So oh, wow.
Far. Yeah, I've got a full schedule this year, including, well, pretty much spanning the whole continental United States plus Canada. I've got two shows in Canada this year.
Oh, awesome, man.
Sadly, I've not been to Australia yet.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, I think we've only got like two or three Comic-Cons over here. So,
yeah.
But I think it's getting better.
Do you have one in the town that you're based in?
In Melbourne, yes. Yeah. I think there's a big one in Melbourne. I think it's PAX, P-A-X.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
I'm no expert on the Comic-Cons. There's probably listeners going, oh, you idiot. You forgot about this and this. But it'd be great to have you down under someday, Bill.
I would love that.
And there's a lot of people that would have bought Simpsons comics at their newsagent back in the day.
Yeah, Otter Press. When I was editor-in-chief at Bongo, I used to get all the foreign, well, not all of them, but quite a few of the foreign comics came across my desk. You know, just it was part of my job to kind of check them out and make sure everything was up to snuff. And so I've still got a pretty good collection of Otter Press Simpsons comics from Australia, yeah.
Oh, nice. I remember you had the junk mail section where people could write in and submit their little pictures and stuff. I was once real stoked because I wrote in and they published it and it got a reply. I asked questions like, what is Bart allergic to? I don't know why that was one of my questions, but do you remember, did you have anything to do with like responding to them or publishing the letters for the US version at least?
The US version, yes. Kind of early on when it was me and Steve and Cindy Vance running the show, we would look at the letters and I think there might have been a few that they threw my way if there were specific questions sort of, you know, geared toward me. But then once Steve and Cindy left, our staff got a little bit bigger. We had more support staff in the office. And I think at that point we had somebody in the office who was responsible for answering all the mail. At one point, I'm pretty sure it was Scott Gimple, who was my editorial assistant, and Scott went on to become the showrunner, which is a fancy way of saying head writer for The Walking Dead.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. I think there was a real cool thing you did with a Radioactive Man comic once where you had like a fake letter section, and it was because it was meant to be like a Radioactive Man comic from, I don't know, the 70s or something, and you had like characters had written in. It was like Homer, age 10.
Yeah.
Nice touch.
We sort of took a cue from, there was an episode of The Simpsons called, I think it was Brush with Greatness.
Yes, with Ringo Starr.
One with Ringo, Marge writes to Ringo and she gets a reply many, many years later. So I think that was sort of the inspiration for the letters column in Radioactive Man, because we thought, oh, it would be fun, you know, if this is a book that, you know, is Bart Simpson's favorite comic book, then it makes sense that when his parents were kids or the other adults in Springfield, when they were kids, they would have read Radioactive Man and probably written letters and gotten gotten answers back. So got their letters printed.
Someone did a video not long ago pointing out that if Itchy and Scratchy has in fact been around for like 100 years in the Simpsons universe, that means that Homer would have watched it when he was a kid. And I was like, oh yeah. Whoa. It's some potential there for a story.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of, I mean, to my knowledge, I don't think they ever did an episode that dealt with Homer being an Itchy and Scratchy fan as a kid. And I don't think we ever did a comic book to that effect either. So missed opportunity there.
You can write that one down.
Yeah.
At the comic conventions you've been at, for those that don't know, the listening people can come up to you and get you to sign stuff or like draw them as a Simpson character or even just draw a Simpsons Futurama character. Last time, I think I asked which ones you prefer drawing. I think you said like Radioactive Man, Bender are some of your favorites. Are there any that like stump you? Like, because there's so many characters. Is anyone like, yo, I want the guy from the box factory or...
Oh, yeah. All the time. But luckily, you know, we've got smartphones now. So as long as the Wi-Fi is good at a convention, I can always just do a quick Google search and find what I'm looking for. You know, I sometimes do that for even some of the regular characters because, you know, like lately I've drawn several Duffman requests.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I can draw Duffman from memory now, but a couple of years ago I couldn't because I'd maybe only drawn Duffman a handful of times in my career. So I didn't have that muscle memory and I had to, you know, sort of look and cheat a little bit and remind myself of all the details just so, you know, you always have sort of a general idea of what a character looks like, but you know, if you're doing a sketch for a fan and they're probably going to end up posting it on the internet, you know, you want it to be good.
Yeah. You don't want people to be like, hey, Bill Morrison only drew 4 beer cans on his belt instead of 6. What the hell? I guess if you're stuck, you could have a look at the large poster that you drew about 20 or so years ago, right? I'm actually, don't know if you caught my coffee mug, but it's got the...
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's cool.
For listeners, it's got to be one of the most seen items of merch, right?
Oh, yeah. They used it. Originally, I did it for the... they had a binder back then for the style guide, for the merchandise style guide.
Right.
So you got actually a printed style guide in a binder. You know, it was like a 3-ring thing so you could take out the pages. And then this one, it was late 90s, so it also had CDs. So it had a pocket with CDs that had all the same artwork that was in the printed version. But they asked me to do this piece of art for the binder cover, you know, for the front and back. And then I think, you know, it was such a popular piece of art that the licensees wanted to use it. I don't think it was in the original style guide. It was just printed on the cover.
Oh, right.
But I think a lot of the licensees said, hey, can we use this? You know, can we get like a line art version or like a real high res version of this? So they made it available and then you started seeing it on, you know, bedspreads and puzzles and posters and all kinds of things, mugs.
I think I had a puzzle of it. Yeah. When I was a kid. Yeah. And it had like a little list attached, which had all the names of the characters, which I thought was
right,
a nice touch.
Had a legend that had just silhouettes of the like outline drawings of the characters.
There's been an extended version of that too, right? Because I think when you released it was what, late 90s? And then the show kept going. So they kept introducing more and more characters. So did they then get you to just add to that poster?
No, I didn't do the updated one.
Right.
By that time, I'd sort of, even though I still do merchandise art to this day, when I was super busy with Bongo, there was sort of a Matt Graney's lawyer sort of put out the word that I was not to be disturbed.
Okay.
she wanted me to just focus my energy on Bongo. So there was a period where I wasn't really allowed to do merchandise art unless they were really in a crunch, and then they were able to come to me if they just, you know, really needed help, couldn't find anybody else to work on something. But I was at Universal Studios back in January.
Cool.
And went to the downtown Springfield area, and I was in the Krusty Burger, and I saw the poster on the wall. They had like a big version of it, and I said, "Oh, that's my art there. That's my poster." And then I started looking at it more closely, and I went, "Wait a minute! I didn't draw that. I didn't do that one." So I realized a big chunk of it was mine, but they had really expanded it. Yeah,
there's like a version of it I've seen with Dredrick Tatum and his manager Lucius Sweet, although mm-hmm. they're both yellow on the mm-hmm. poster. But then in a bunch of other versions, they've got the Australian judge, or the Prime Minister of Australia, mm-hmm. and I think it's Sherry and Terry's mum, if memory serves. So it's like Dredrick Tatum and Lucius Sweet were removed and replaced with those characters. Does that ring any bells to you?
No. No.
You're like, what the hell is he talking about?
You think, I don't know. Maybe it's an Australia only version. They wanted to get maybe. The Prime Minister. Oh, that's funny. I do know that in the original poster, I accidentally included a couple of characters twice.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
But they're colored differently. And there are also some coloring mistakes. I didn't do the coloring, so I can't be blamed for that. But
good. Yep.
Yeah, there are some coloring mistakes, and definitely a character or two that are duplicated.
Well, because if you've got that commission now, like draw all everyone from The Simpsons, I guess computers would play a big part. But you did it all by hand back in the day. Is that right?
Yeah, the way we did it was we took, you know, there's the main model drawings that the animators use.
Yep.
So I had a big collection of those, because every time I would work on, you know, I used to do the advertising for the TV guide ads. So pretty much every time there was a new character, they would send me the model sheet. I used to save them in a binder, and I had, you know, I had a big collection of pretty much every character up to that point. And we didn't sort of, through one of my friends at Bongo, Chris Unger, we assembled the group in the computer. We scanned the sheets and then put them in the computer just to give me a rough starting point, you know, so that all the characters would be kind of the same size.
Yeah,
and then I made some changes, you know, I changed arm positions and turned heads and things like that. But I had sort of a rough blueprint to work over. And then once I had, you know, gotten the pencil drawing the way I wanted it, then I, you know, did a big inking of it. And it was huge. The original art was, you know, it was maybe three feet wide by a couple feet high.
Yeah, wow. Do you have the original copy anywhere? Still say
no. Back then, I do have original art from back then, but it's mostly the pencils, because I would do the pencil drawing, and then the inks would be done on an overlay, mm-hmm. like on a light box, and I would have to send in the inks because I didn't have a scanner.
Oh right.
so I didn't have the ability to scan something and then just send them a TIFF or a JPEG or a Photoshop file. I had to physically send the inks, and sometimes they came back to me, but most often they didn't. So a lot of the original inks probably still exist at Fox somewhere.
Yeah, right.
In a drawer, you know.
There are certain characters that I'm sure you know how to draw off the top of your head, but are there any that are a pain in the ass? Like when someone requests it, you're like, ugh, that character.
Lisa's always really tough.
Yeah.
Just because if you don't get the shape of her hair correct, it just looks off. Like you could be off by a little and it looks like you're off by a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't mind drawing Lisa if I can pencil, you know, can rough it out in pencil and then ink it. But if somebody asks me to do Lisa on like a comic book cover, so I have to just go for it with a Sharpie.
Yeah.
Never sure if it's going to come out right.
Yeah. So you sure you don't want Radioactive Man instead?
Yeah. It's always a little bit scary, and it's kind of like a high wire act, you know, like working without a net, because if somebody hands you their copy of Simpsons number one and you screw it up with a bad drawing, you know, I can't just tear that up and, you know, pull out a new copy of Simpsons number one and start over, you know?
Yeah. I have noticed that, because I like drawing the Simpsons, like doodling them, and I drew them all the time as kids. And yeah, Lisa was always tricky, but I did have that, the book Cartooning with the Simpsons, which I think you had something to do with, right? It's like a handbook for drawing the characters.
Yeah, I did all the very bad drawings in that. I mean, they weren't bad at the time, but now you look at them and they're like, oh my God, you know, because the models have changed over the years. So now they just look terribly off model.
It's funny that it would have been quite gradual though over the years. So you don't really notice that they're slightly changing. And then you look back 10, 15 years later and you're like, oh.
Right. Yeah, I looked at that book recently and I was horrified.
It had some real cool stuff. I really liked the way it broke down how to draw them. Like, I think that's how I found out that Bart has 9 points on his head. But it's also like, it has like, imagine Marge has this amount of bowling balls in her hair. Or so, like stuff like that. Or like, imagine Bart's head is a tin can. Little terminology like that, I think, really helped make it easier.
Yeah, but that really came from David Silverman,
right?
You know, one of the main animation directors. And, you know, one of the things I would get from the studios or from the studio, in addition to the main model sheets, is I would get David's drawing notes. You know, here's how you draw this character. Here are the do's and the don'ts about Homer. And that was his way of explaining to the animators simple ways to remember how the characters are constructed. So I, you know, when we did that book and also the Simpsons handbook that came later, we really took cues from David and the way he, you know, kind of broke things down and simplified how the characters are constructed.
Yeah, nice. I find when I'm doodling and stuff, I like drawing Barney, but like he's got all different points on his head. And I imagine, even though it looks messy, like that's the point, he's got messy hair, right? But I imagine when you draw him, there's a specific way those points have to angle, right?
Yeah, I mean, in order for it to look right in animation, it has to be pretty regimented. But that being said, there are characters who are definitely more organic in the way they're designed than the main family members are. Main family, they're obviously very geometric in their designs. But yeah, characters like Barney, you can be off on his hair design in a static drawing and it still looks right. It still looks like Barney. In animation, it's a little trickier because it has to be, you know, it has to be consistent from drawing to drawing.
Yeah.
In order for the animation not to jump around, you know.
Yeah, true. But if his hair's a little different to how it was on page 3 to page 8, no one's really gonna notice.
Yeah, in comics, you wouldn't really tell if Barney was off a little bit. Whereas, you know, if I was off drawing Bart's hair a little bit, it would be obvious because of that geometric factor.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the hardest ones that I find, because like mates might be like, "Oh, Murphy, you're good at drawing The Simpsons. Draw Principal Skinner." I struggle with characters like that are actually like don't really have any notable. Whereas if you do a bad drawing of like Sideshow Bob or Sideshow Mel, you're probably still going to know it who they are. But like someone like Skinner, it's just a guy in a suit.
Yeah, Skinner's, there's not a lot about him that's super unique.
Mm.
Other than, you know, maybe I always have trouble with his hair shape because he's got a very distinct wave.
Yeah.
To his, the bangs, you know. But other than that, you know, he's pretty unremarkable.
You do a lot of commissions for people. So I really like on your Instagram, you'll sometimes share the more interesting ones. Sometimes it's like Homer as a specific DC or Marvel superhero, right? Or like right. little mashups of different, like The Simpsons as such and such. Are there any particular ones that you've come to mind from recent months that you've had commissioned?
Oh, gosh. God, I've done so many.
Well, listeners, you can check out Bill's Instagram, by the way, Atomic Battery, and you can see some of the ones he's posted.
There's one idea that I had a lot of fun with that was not a Simpsons character, but it was Vampirella.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the customer wanted, this was at a convention, the customer wanted Vampirella venomized.
Oh, you know, okay.
Venom.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I got it right. I don't know if they wanted me to like draw Vampirella as Venom or turning into Venom. But I basically just drew her as a Simpsons character, like in the Simpsons style. And the like the black ooze of Venom was starting to sort of crawl up her leg and get on her arm. You know, so she was, it was kind of like a couple of moments before she would have been taken over by Venom. And I was pretty happy with that one. That was fun. You know, sometimes you go into a drawing, especially if it's kind of a wild request.
Yeah.
With the feeling of, I don't know about this. This doesn't sound like fun, number one. And I don't think the customer's going to be particularly pleased when I'm done because, you know, I just don't see this working out. And then you get to the end and it's like a happy surprise. It's like, oh, that actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah, nice. There's got to be some that you're knocking back, not to get too blue, but I imagine sometimes customers at the comic conventions are asking some stuff like, can you like draw Leela naked? Or like, can you draw Homer and Marge doing it? Or am I overestimating how perverse some of these people are?
I think a lot of artists do get that.
Yeah.
But happily, I have not had that with Simpsons fans.
Nice.
And I don't That's know if it's know. Just this. I don't know if it's just that Simpsons fans are kind of a classier bunch.
Yeah.
And don't want to ask for things like that. Or maybe they just kind of know that I've spent so many years sort of as a guardian of the characters in my position at Bongo that maybe they just, you know, already have a sense that I'm not going to go for that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I mentioned at the top, but you were also at Bongo Comics, did Futurama Comics, and you've worked quite a bit with Futurama. You helped design characters and stuff as well.
Yeah.
I did notice when the Futurama comics came out, they did, I guess the great thing about the Simpsons comics is they're quite like the show, Futurama quite like the show. And Futurama the show had a bit more like adult humor, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Just,
and I actually was surprised, I think, that some of the comics did have like a few, nothing too lewd, but, you know, a few sexual references and stuff. How is that when you're doing comics? Like, how does it work with censorship and what you can and can't do?
Well, for a while, I mean, for many years, but especially particularly the early years of Bongo, we had the comics code. So we were still under the auspices of the American Comics Code. So there was like a built-in set of rules of things that you could or couldn't do if you wanted to have newsstand distribution.
Okay.
So even though a lot of comics carried the comics code and were sold in comic shops, they didn't really have to have the code for a comic shop.
Okay.
But the way the code was set up originally back in the 1950s, it was actually set up by a group of publishers. So it wasn't like a government mandate or anything like that. It was a group of publishers that got together and they, you know, comics were getting a very bad reputation, mainly because of EC Comics. The EC horror comics were, you know, very bloody and gory and really well done, but, you know, not what you would call kid friendly.
Right.
But a lot of kids read them and parents got upset. So there was, I don't know how much you know about this in Australia, but there was a House of Representatives committee on juvenile delinquency. And part of that was examining comic books and whether or not comics were contributing to the delinquency of minors. And they had, you know, they had actually Bill Gaines, who was the publisher of EC Comics, come in and testify. And it didn't go well, let's just say. And, you know, all these other publishers got nervous because they're like, here's this guy with this company that has these very adult comics, and we're getting tainted by that. You know, our comics are not bad, but they're being painted with the same brush. So they banded together and they basically created a code that condemned and forbade most of the things that were in those EC comics. So they had things like, well, you can't have the word crypt in your title. Well, he had Tales from the Crypt. Right. You can't have the word horror in your title. He had the Vault of Horror. And then things like, you can't have werewolves, you can't have vampires, you can't have zombies or the undead. So they came up with all these things that basically put him out of business. And it's actually what led to Mad Magazine, because the one publication he had that was kind of safe from the comics code was Mad Comics. And they had, you know, like 20 some issues of Mad Comics, but he said, you know what, screw it, I'm going to turn this into a magazine so they can't touch me, because magazines can be on the newsstand for sale and they don't have to have this new comics code. So that's how Mad became a magazine. And then he became, you know, way more successful with Mad Magazine than he ever was with the horror comics.
Wow.
So, you know, just a little backstory there. But, you know, by the time Bongo came along, we still had the comics code. So, you know, comic shop distribution, they didn't really care what was in your books. So that's why you had Pacific Comics in the 80s, and you had a lot of comics that had things in them that really weren't allowed by the comics code, but those books weren't sold on newsstands.
Right.
And newsstand distribution in the US includes supermarkets, convenience stores, bookstores, you know, pretty much everything except the direct market, which is comic shops. But by the time Bongo came along, the comics code was also getting to be a little toothless. So they had relaxed their restrictions quite a bit. So I remember looking at what the restrictions were, and there was nothing in the comics code that was anything we really wanted to do anyway in Simpsons Comics.
Yeah.
Like it didn't seem restrictive at all. It looked like, well, we're, you know, any Simpsons story we do is going to pass muster with no problem, because the standards had been relaxed to such a point. By the time Futurama came in, the comics code, I think, was gone by that time completely.
Oh, okay.
And if not, it might have been on its way out, and we weren't really concerned about having the code seal on our books anyway.
Yeah. So, right.
Yeah, so we felt very free to just match the tone of humor that existed on the TV show for that one.
Yeah. Because Simpsons, you can kind of get away with not having any adult jokes. But I mean, well, Bender alone, right? He's cigar smoking, drinking, going to brothels. That's...
Oh, yeah.
You kind of got to...
Definitely a much more adult set of characters. Futurama was really like an adult workplace comedy.
Yeah.
Just happened to be set in the future. Whereas Simpsons was obviously and is, you know, more of a family living room sitcom. So, yeah, with more kids, obviously more kids in the cast. So you're going to have, you know, a different tone there between the two shows to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. Futurama, you've got Cubert, Farnsworth's clone, and Hermes' son. That's about it with the kid cast, right?
Right. Yeah.
Last time I was on the show, I showed you my very mangled original edition of The Complete Guide. I'm holding it up to the screen, falling
even,
apart.
Even more mangled now.
Yep. Hasn't turned to dust just yet. Was there ever any discussion of a Futurama version of that?
Oh yeah, we actually I think there were some episodes that were written up. Patrick Verone, who is one of the writers on the show, he was really interested in writing it. And
cool.
I believe I have a memory of him writing some sample episode write-ups. And I have no memory or no idea why we never ended up publishing the book. Could be just that by the time we sort of got our act together, the show was done.
Yeah.
The first time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it came back the second time, you know, I was still at Bongo, and I think there was some talk about resurrecting the project, but I don't know, somehow it never got off the ground. I don't really have a strong memory of why, but it's a shame, you know. One of the frustrating things with the Simpsons Guide is somebody started doing one online, and it was pretty thorough, as I recall. And we were already well into doing the books, but they were kind of mimicking our style and, you know, doing the same thing, but with easier access and cheaper, obviously, for fans because they didn't have to buy a book.
Yeah.
So I remember that taking the wind out of our sails a little bit. You know, there was a bit of a feeling of, you know, why are we knocking ourselves out doing this when somebody else is doing it online and fans can get it for free?
Yeah, yeah. Since speaking with you last, I have got my hands on this bad boy. So
the brick, we used to call it.
Exactly. I'm not gonna hold that for too long. Yeah, shout out to Robin Lucy.
Makes a good doorstop too.
Oh yeah, true. Okay. I'll keep that in mind. I thought I'd do a game with you, Bill. We do this with guests on the show when we talk about an episode. We get them to guess which character has been highlighted for that particular episode.
Oh, okay.
You've got an advantage here, because you edited the book, right? So
many, many, many years ago. I want to remind.
Yeah. So let's see if you can get this first one. I thought I'd choose a few episodes that are, you know, related to comics. So we've got Three Men and a Comic Book, the one where they get their hands on Radioactive Man comic number one, right?
Okay.
Who do you think
I believe that would be comic book guy.
Oh, see, you said it was many years ago, but look at that. It's Comic Book Guy, so well done.
All right, I got it.
You should just be like, well, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. See ya. Disconnect.
Yeah.
So another one, which I know is probably got a special place in your heart because you ended up doing a comic version of this episode, and it's all about your favorite character, Radioactive Man.
Oh, yeah.
Where they make the film Radioactive Man. Who do you think they've chosen to highlight for that one?
I want to say Rainier Wolfcastle.
Rainier Wolfcastle. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Boom. There he is. Rainier Wolfcastle. You got it. It's all coming back to you.
God, I'm doing better than I thought I would.
Well, it's a classic episode for him. It's got the classic... The goggles line, right?
Here's a fun fact about that episode. I used to record all the episodes on VHS tape, like when they aired.
Yeah.
Just so I would have a reference, because for a long time, you know, they wouldn't put them out on VHS for, you know, until, you know, a couple of years after they first aired. There were no DVDs. And so I had this great library of all the episodes, and I would just, you know, keep it really up to date. And the original line for that episode was, "I'll be in my trailer," like as he's being washed away. So he says, "I'll be in my trailer." Because I remember seeing it the first time they reran it, and he says, "The goggles do nothing." And I went, "Wait a minute.
Oh,
that's not what he said. He said, I'll be in my trailer." I'm like 99% sure. And I went back to the videotape, and sure enough, I was right. So for some reason, they revised that line of dialogue when they re-ran it. It's been that way ever since.
I don't think I'll be in my trailer. I mean, that's funny, but I don't think that would have been as quoted.
Oh, no. It's not nearly as iconic, right?
Yeah. I like you're having to record the episodes on VHS. Fox couldn't just send you a few copies or...
No, and as a matter of fact, when I was working in-house at Fox in the licensing and merchandising department, the executives in that department used to come to me to get copies, like if they wanted to review, if they're working on a toy or something that was specific to an episode, they would come to me and say, Bill, do you have the episode where, you know, Bart gets a spy camera or whatever? And I'd say, yeah, here it is right here. And one time I remember saying, I have no problem loaning these to you, but I'm just surprised you can't get these from Fox. And they were like, yeah, we could, but it's too much trouble. It takes too long. It's easier just to get from you.
Wow. That's wild. I used to record them on VHS. My parents were doing like a big cleanup of the house a few years ago and just found like 50 videos, all labeled. I'd written which episodes were on which one. And my mom was like, we don't need this. We don't need this. So she put them in like a, I don't know if you use the term skip in America, like a big trough to throw rubbish in. Yeah. And during the night, my dad snuck out and grabbed them all and snuck back into the house.
Good on him. You know what? Know what they're really great for is some people record or used to record things live and they would pause during the commercials.
Yeah.
But you just let it run. Sometimes those commercials, just being able to see those in context with the show, like these are the commercials that ran when this show aired the first time.
100%.
A lot of the Butterfinger commercials, you know, the Simpsons, Bart Simpson Butterfinger commercials and all kinds of fun stuff. Yeah.
Oh, if only I had had that foresight, because I was one of those people that paused the ads, because you fit more episodes on, right? Save the fast forwarding. But now, as someone craving 90s nostalgia, I'm like, man, should have just let it run.
Right.
Third and final episode, I'll get you to guess.
Okay, let's see if I can get the trifecta.
Yeah, I thought I'd pick it because it's the Beatles parody, Homer's Barbershop Quartet, and you're a big Beatles fan. Which character do you think they've chosen for that flashback episode, Homer's Barbershop Quartet?
I don't remember us doing a George Harrison drawing. He's the guest star.
Mm-hmm. It's not George Harrison, I'll confirm.
Yeah, like I'm trying to... The reason I said Rainer Wolfcastle on the last one is because I remember that image of him, the standing image of him in the costume.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
In the book. So I thought, it must be that one. But I don't have a memory of us doing like a full figure George Harrison. So
I'll give you a clue. It's a character that, as far as I know, pretty certain, at least in the classic years, did not appear in any other episode. Only Homer's Barbershop Quartet.
Is it the Barney's Yoko character?
Oh, that's a good guess, but it's not, sadly.
Okay.
It is the character Nigel, which is their manager.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what?
We used him in the comics, though.
I was about to say, yeah. I have this memory of, I think it's like Santa's Little Helper becomes famous.
Right.
And he's manager.
He's actually on the cover. Yeah, he made the cover of that issue, yeah.
All the Nigel fans were very happy. They were like, yes. You did do that a fair bit. I think you used the comics to your advantage and like brought a lot of those one-time characters back. Particularly one, not that I think Nigel's just Dan Castellaneta, but characters that were guest voiced that would have been tricky to come back in the show, you would have been like, well.
Right. The thing we couldn't do with guest stars is if they appeared as themselves on the show.
Right. Yeah.
We couldn't use them in the comics without their permission.
Yeah.
So like we had Stan Lee in the comic book guy, the miniseries.
Oh yeah,
comic book. And we actually went to Stan and got written permission from him to use him in the comic book.
Oh, awesome. That's cool. Yeah, I think one of the great things about the comics is, like the show, they would do a lot of parodies and reference stuff that if you didn't get the parody, it was fine. Like, you could still enjoy the comic.
Yes.
But then later on, you might be like, oh, hey, that's from this. I was flipping through, I think it was Simpsons Comics number 3, like a really old one. And it's like someone steals the Puma statue.
Right.
And that, I realized flicking through it, was a parody of the Maltese Falcon, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And Steve Vance wrote that story. Yeah. And Steve was always very knowledgeable about old films, especially film noir. So that's definitely a Steve reference.
There was a lot of dialogue in that where I was just like, oh man, that went over my head as a boy. Like, but I just remember loving the comic. And yeah, it's great. You can then, much like the show, you can take a look at it 20 years later and be like, ah, didn't get that.
I used to tell writers all the time, this was like a big thing as editor, that I was always trying to communicate in terms of references and background jokes and things like that. I always said it can be so obscure that only 5 people get it. I don't care.
Yeah.
Only you get it, you know, as long as it doesn't interrupt the story and make the reader somehow confused.
Mm.
You know, if it has nothing to do with the story keeps flowing, and it's a reference that you either get it or you don't. As long as the story isn't affected, then you're fine.
Yeah, great
so
advice.
That particularly came up during Radioactive Man, because we, you know, we're not only doing a parody of mainstream pop culture, we're doing a deeper dive into comics. And so we realized that a lot of our readers probably hadn't read Charlton Comics in the 1960s and didn't know who Dr. Solar was, you know?
Yep.
So we were able to do Dr. Solar jokes or whatever, as long as it was something that didn't affect the story, but it was a nice little Easter egg for people that did get the joke.
For sure. I think the back comic for the number 3, so you've got the Simpsons Mystery, which is the main story. And then this particular one, speaking of referencing and parodying comics, was called Krusty Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big...
Agent of Clown.
Oh, doy, sorry. Yes. Agent. That would have been a bit too on the nose if it was just Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Sorry. Agent of Clown, C-L-O-W-N, with the dots in between, much like S.H.I.E.L.D.
Right.
And I'm not a massive comic nerd. There's a lot I don't know, but I obviously picked up now. That's parodying like Nick Fury. But I was flipping through it and there was like a particular page where it was like, I was like, this is parodying something, but I got no idea.
Is it the silent page?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've since looked it up. It's like a particular Nick Fury comic by, I can't remember his name. You'll be better at explaining it, please.
Yeah, Jim Steranko. It's a famous page that has Nick Fury having a romantic evening with his girlfriend, who's also an agent, Val. And it's all silent. It's all just done, you know, in just visual panels. And the final panel shows Fury's gun in his holster, like it's kind of like draped over a chair or something. And it's a sexual innuendo implying that they're having intercourse because the gun is in the holster. And so when we did Krusty Agent of Clown, Steve wrote that one as well. And he wanted to definitely do a parody of that silent Steranko page. Yeah.
And what is an amazing touch, and I found this out by Googling it. I think I found a Reddit thread that explain this, is in the last panel in the Krusty version, it has the gun in the holster, but there's like a, it looks like someone's put a pin on a note, and it's like a note from the editor, and it says,
yeah,
including this picture of the gun might upset the anti-violence people. Can we just put a panel of Krusty and Miss Penny Candy making out instead, or something like that?
Yeah.
I'm like, that's so clever, because it was like the opposite of that in reality. Yeah. Like, oh man, that's good stuff. We'll wrap it up, Bill. Is there anything you've got coming up or anything you'd like to plug, Simpsons or non-Simpsons related?
Well, I'm currently working on some style guide images for The Simpsons that I think will only appear in Asia.
Oh, so okay.
They're being done specifically for the Disney Corporation over there, I think for the theme parks. So it'll be like a whole new batch of Simpsons images that they'll put on merchandise and things that you can only get there. I'm working on, back in the Bongo days, I introduced a comic of my own called Roswell, Little Green Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I'm bringing Roswell back. I'm doing a Kickstarter and, probably announce that in the next month or so. And it's, well, I actually just announced it now, didn't I? so it'll collect all the Roswell material to date. And then hopefully from there, I'll start creating new Roswell stories.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
Yeah. So that's exciting. The other thing I'm working on right now is, you probably have never heard of this character, but, there's a network in the US called MeTV.
Okay.
MeTV. And it's basically a network that shows reruns of classic television.
Oh, yeah.
But on Saturday nights, they have a horror show, like a horror movie show. And they have, you know, it's a comedy thing with a live host and, you know, a cast of characters. So they'll show an old Universal, you know, Frankenstein movie, but in between they have little comedy bits. And the name of the character is Svengoolie. And we're doing a comic book version of Svengoolie.
Oh, great.
There's one issue out, which I contributed to, and the second issue is going to be coming out. They're kind of being put out as specials,
yeah,
rather than like a monthly book, you know, so they come out sporadically. But I'm writing and drawing, not really writing, I'm dialoguing a 10-page story. It's actually being written by the guy who plays Svengoolie on TV, Rich Coase.
Cool.
So I'm doing a cover and a 10-page story for that.
Oh, nice. And also, I did mention Beatles earlier. You can still buy them, the graphic novels that you worked on for the Yellow Submarine.
Yeah. The original graphic novel came out in 2018. And I think it's out of print from Titan Books.
Mm-hmm.
But a new publisher has picked it up, and they're doing... I think they launched it in September of last year.
Cool.
I think that's when it came out. So it's pretty much an identical version of the original book. And that's a company called Insight Editions.
Yeah.
So you can find it online, Amazon, or wherever you buy your books, they would have it.
It's got rave reviews. I think any Beatles fan would love to have that one. So
you know what, that was one of the most gratifying things is when I was doing it, I was very concerned that Beatles fans would not receive it well.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the film's so brilliant, and
yeah,
you know, this is a silent, non-moving version of a beautifully animated film with fantastic Beatles music, you know. So
yeah,
I really had that fear that it, you know, Beatles fans would just either ignore it or give it a big thumbs down. But I was pleasantly surprised that Beatles fans have really embraced it. So
yeah,
that's been one of the most gratifying things in my career.
Fantastic. Well, check it out and check out all Bill's stuff online. Like I said before, Instagram is Atomic Battery on Instagram. You can check out my stuff at murphymclachlan.com. Please rate and review the podcast. Bill, it's been fantastic having you back on the podcast. Love chatting with you. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Murphy. And anytime you want to have me back, I'm happy to come on.
Thanks, Bill. Love it. And as we always say here on Murph's Tavern,
bye.